Is there anything to say from yesterday? To ask, or something that you digested and would share? So I would like to continue. We only got through 2 of 5 signs of breakthrough yesterday. I'd like to continue to talk about what's better than pleasant. What's more worthwhile than a completely pleasant world, living in a completely pleasant world. There's the scene in the conversation between one person that I mentioned yesterday, who's a teacher in his own right, who's talking to the Buddha. And as he talks to the Buddha, he keeps realizing that what he thought all along was true and what he'd been teaching doesn't make any sense. And then he says, "You've ended the conversation, you've ended the conversation." And Buddha says, "What do you mean?" And Sakaludayan says, "What I thought was worth practicing for, you've shown to be a fake." But still, my question is, so the teacher who's the student, the teacher who's asking Buddha questions in front of his own students, my question still is there a completely pleasant world? And is there a way, a practical way to get there? And as I said yesterday, the Buddha says yes. And part of the practical way to get to a completely pleasant world includes allowing these difficult inner situations to come up, like ill will and lack, comparing mind, hatred. Allowing them to come up and not allowing them to stop us. And what's important in the story of Sakaludayan talking to Buddha and keeps asking, okay, so we get through these difficult states, and then what? Is that when it's completely pleasant? And the Buddha says, no, not yet. And so then you go into deep meditation, and it's very pleasant. And Sakaludayan says, so then that's it. Then you've kind of created your bubble of a completely pleasant world. And the Buddha says, no, not yet. From the states, the deep states of connection and not believing the inner critic and not believing in lack, and not believing that when our buttons get pushed, what we think is true. Not believing what we think when we're feeling defensive. And a few more difficulties that we'll talk about more today. We could direct our path going through these difficulties into deep meditation, into deeper and deeper connection with aliveness, into a completely pleasant experience. The Buddha says that we can do that if we want. And so Sakaludayan says, so that must be why all these people have come to you and are taking teachings from you, to do this amazing thing, to be able to just block out all the unpleasantness. And the Buddha says, no, that's not why we're here. You could do it, and you'll even meet people who, beings who live in heaven, and you can even talk to them.
Wow. Wow, and so what?
Or we could direct the energy of our practice, this dedication that's happened to us, which is deeper than when I try to dedicate my life on purpose. So we do both. We dedicate ourselves on purpose, and there's also some deeper pull that we give space to, as I mentioned in the first Dharma talk. Instead of just going to heaven and hanging out with all the dudes in heaven, we can use the power that accumulates, that becomes available, for what the Buddha says is higher and more sublime than completely pleasant. So when I talked about the season, the loquat season, I talked about a juiciness that's better than pleasant. So I'm calling it juiciness, and the Buddha calls it higher and more sublime. I think the word sublime is good because it gives a sense of something that's very subtle. Something very subtle. Something that's not easy to feel. It takes practice to feel it. It takes our willingness to stand the heat while we boil the water out of the milk, so that what's left is just nurturance. So when there's heat, when there is reaction, not freaking out, but staying true to the possibility of something better than pleasant, something better than getting away from this heat. Or passing the heat to somebody else. One thing that we can do with the power that we start to gather, that starts to happen, starts to be available as gentleness comes into our atmosphere. One is that the past starts to resolve, which means we're not interested in relating to the past anymore. Which means I'm not interested in relating to you as my past idea, or my idea based on my past with you. Which in a way means I'm not interested in relating. The way that we hear relating usually means relating to past. Whereas something more like refreshing rather than relating. Relating is late. It's late again. Relate. And it's possible to refresh. It's important what Rose brought up at the end of the talk yesterday, that we start to recover natural protection that comes only when it's needed and doesn't just stay on and work against what it wishes to do. And we'll get to that today. But the possibility of fresh instead of past in this world. And what happens when we're no longer addicted to having a weight on our shoulder in order to feel that I'm here? The weight of the past is seen through, accepted as it is. What has happened has happened. It's possible to feel sensitively in each moment how we hurt ourselves and others and how we help ourselves and others, just in a very matter-of-fact way. And so we start to come in contact with the sense of what is true profit. Without any selfishness. And what I think is the most important thing that can happen when we allow power to be present with us without anywhere to go, not power for a reason, not power to get or defend, not so it's unchanneled power, it's available power, which can be scary when we think about it. So we feel power and then we think about power and we get scared because we see how power is usually used. But if we could just stay friendly with the actual experience of power, not to let the mind freak out, but let the mind get more and more flexible, being in contact with the warmth of this power that is in aliveness or is of aliveness or is aliveness. It actually starts to help the mind to be more flexible and steady. And it helps the mind to be bright. It helps the mind to be of help. Instead of dominant. And in a kind of seeing that's with many levels of seeing, a very steady place of seeing an impossibility of neediness, which is not the same as rejecting needs. And a kind of experiential, many levels seeing or feeling that we don't need to run and answer the phone and the door every time it rings. We can kind of turn off the alertness that we spoke about this morning. We don't need to run around and get anywhere or anything. Being in touch with aliveness, the need is also present and is answered by itself. We don't need to interfere. We don't need to come up with neediness in order to get. Does that make sense? Another way to put it is we've experienced needs not being met. And so we construct, it's almost like not the business that the Buddha recommended starting yesterday, but we construct, we kind of try to make a kind of business that will support us, we hope. And it doesn't. If we would ever stop and do the accounts, it doesn't support us. It takes more than it gives. So we construct a posture of not having and needing to force it to come. And we know that even if we manage, we force it and it does come, it doesn't actually satisfy. Even if we eat it and swallow it, we're still hungry. So the impossibility of neediness as pretense, and need as just so natural that, of course, what is needed comes. What is truly needed. Yes. What usually is truly needed is some form of teaching, not usually literal teaching, but some shift of perspective, for example, or some encouragement to go with the inner teaching is really what it is. And when there's a settlement in the being, there's a kind of enthusiasm for settling more, settling so much that need and fulfillment of need is immediate. And I don't need to know about it. And so wherever there's a gap between my way of functioning, wherever there's a way that my way of functioning is blocking what's needed, I'm still open to receive the encouragement to listen better and be more responsive to put it in a really simple way, the simple voice, the inner voice. And later on, there's not even a voice intervening. There's just simple living, simple action or not action. So the difference between how we usually function and what happens when we allow power to be with us and to let it be our ally, to accept that it could be our ally, our friend, is that we don't take it as something wrong when we notice something wrong. If I notice a gap, if I notice something out of place in my experience, in myself, I don't freak out. I don't take it as my fault. There's an eagerness to learn in the whole system, not just my thinking about myself, but my whole system is hungry in a very healthy way for learning, for coming into settlement. What usually happens in our normal functioning is if we notice something wrong, we really take it as a problem that is my fault and your fault and the world's fault. And we're absolutely stuck. Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
Can you give me an example?
Well, to my understanding, I could give an example that's happening in my life at the minute with my neighbour, that she's because we feel, I'm not sure that it's good for my health, and it's coming out at me, and I can't do anything about it because it's beyond my control.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel stuck then. Don't even know what to do with it.
You don't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. So because you're speaking quietly, I'll broadcast for you, unless you'd like to. Her neighbor has wireless internet, and Anna feels that it has a negative effect on her, on herself. But it's in her neighbor's hands to turn it off. And so Anna feels at a dead end under a negative effect that's not in her hands to turn off. So the question could be, what is more sublime than the absence of wireless waves?
Forgiving my neighbor.
Forgiving my neighbor. Is forgiveness a machine that you can turn on? I think it can be really interesting just to feel any situation, including this one, as a simple situation. And that if there's a need that needs to be met, it will be met. So then we could really feel, fine-tune our feeling to feel whether my reaction and my thinking about the wireless is the pollution in this case, or whether the effect on me is enough of a negative that something else must happen outwardly. And if it's just a simple situation that something else must happen outwardly, then I'm free to allow that to come to mind and body. It could be move. It could be just in the right moment, a conversation with the neighbor or whatever. Or you happen to see that there's a way of stopping the waves by such and such plant or whatever. There is a way. I think that's the main difference when we allow power, energy to be with us and we don't allow the mind to freak out, or the mind forgets to freak out because it's so happy to serve this aliveness, to serve what's most important. There is a way. Don't freak out. There is a way. Don't freak out. And then that way appears. It happens. And then you realize what the way was afterwards. And that way comes in this, the mind that's been softened in the warmth of this energy. It's become bright in the warmth of this energy, in being included in that aliveness. I'll just give another very kind of simple example. Since someone was brave enough to say when I asked if you understood, to say not so much. I went swimming yesterday and my watch can't be in the water as long as I want to be in the water. So I didn't really have an outer way of telling the time. And I definitely wanted to be in the hall according to the outer clock at 3:15 and not just be lost in my inner clock. And so I went for a while and it started to feel like it was time to turn around. The intuition came that it's time to turn around. But I really love to swim and I don't usually get to swim. It's like going for a stroll in the water here. I don't know anywhere else like that. So there was a slight resistance to turning around, yet it can't possibly have been that much time. And I just want you to know that I'm telling this knowing that it's an embarrassing story to tell. So there was this duck that came in front of me, and it didn't fly away. It wasn't scared. It didn't even look really interested in me, but it was looking. We had this quite amazing eye contact, the duck and I. And I'm not at all into eye contact techniques or whatever at all. But the duck got me. And we were right at the same, and the duck was actually a little taller than I. am. And it's not that the duck spoke to me or whatever, but I did start to get the sense, I wonder if it really is time to turn around. And then the duck really went in my way. It was not afraid. It was about this far away from me, looking at me in my way. It wasn't scary also, but it was like this kind of firm pressure of like, yes, turn around. And it was time to turn around. So this, the tendency to want the idea of swimming in a place that I don't usually get to swim, that's just the perfect place to swim. And the reality, this gentle, just turn around. It's another small example. Since I know how embarrassing it can be to really look at yourself, even if no one else sees it, I can publicly embarrass myself as well. There's a second tendency that's deep, that's subtle, that we get to see through and let go of. When we let our power come home to us, let's say, when we let aliveness be with us. So this is again just the context. The Buddha is talking to this guy who is there in front of his own students, which might be sometimes how you feel in yourself. When you feel embarrassed catching yourself doing something silly in front of yourself, in front of all your students. And here and there, the students make an uproar, according to the text, and say, oh, we're lost, along with our teacher, who whatever he was teaching was completely false. And then Sakaludayan had this kind of steadiness, really quite amazing, that would be like quieting everyone down again. Just wait a second, because this guy is saying that we could live in a completely pleasant world. If we want to, we could. And there's something better. And the something better would allow us not to relate to the past and to understand with very bare experiencing how it would be like being naked with all of us. How we hurt and help ourselves and others. And just coming to this very steady place that is much better than any pleasure. That even though it has no ground, it is also rock solid. There's a solidness of knowing that there's no need for neediness. There's no need not to let that gentle intuition turn us around, even without the duck, with or without the duck. But being so glad when there's that gentle confirmation of the intuition, of the other ways of knowing. And at the same time, even though this has a kind of rock solidness to it, the not neediness, not needing to step into the shaky ground of neediness. There's so not neediness that there's also no need to know that I am. There's no need to confirm my existence. There's no movement to decide that I exist. We can know clearly that we don't know if we exist or not. That our actual experience is not either of definitely being, and it's not definitely not being. And we don't need to do the extra kind of layer on top of our experience to make it seem like we are, for myself or others. We can allow things to be flow, complete flow. So sometimes it's really helpful to come behind the scenes of all the sense impressions, the sounds and the tastes and the colors, and to come behind the emotions and the thinking and the body sensations, to just a sense that I am, a sense of am-ness. And sometimes we don't even need that. And there's where our deepest freak out starts to dissolve. The deepest freak out is accepting that I don't know if I am or not. And when I accept that I don't know if I am or not, spaciousness, well, much beyond where the word spaciousness reaches. Vastness. And a vastness that's not separate, so it's a vastness that I'm part of. That's more alive than anything in our imagination. And that is where our deepest freak out happens. The primordial freak out is whenever there's the slightest indication of that vastness, and that I'm not that. Something in us turns away. In a way, something in us passes out. Do you know what that means, to pass out? It's the same thing that happens sometimes in a conversation when you start to get to a really important point and suddenly you lost what you were speaking about and you don't know what was the first half of the sentence, so you can't finish it. If you remember that happening, it's a similar, much more subtle turning away. And so we don't turn away. Something doesn't turn away. And we are seen. We are met. The possibility of turning away, we lose it. It loses its possibility. So I'd like to come back to the third and fourth difficult states that come, that are very much related to these very deep experiences. So we talked about how it will happen, that there comes a feeling of lack that moves us, which would be like being in debt but not realizing that we could start a business and pay the debt back. So staying in debt and moving from there. It's also called a more difficult word to get inside of, but I hope now I gave enough background to get inside. The word covetousness means that I want what you have. It's another word for the same first difficulty that we talked about yesterday as lack, and then ill will and hatred or defensiveness and not being able to direct the will creatively or not allowing the will to be in touch with gratitude. The third difficult mental state that will come sometimes, stronger or less strong, and that we are equipped to learn from and also walk through, is in the family of this deep turning away, which is usually called ignorance, so ignoring, the refusal to know, the refusal to fully experience. And it's really important here that we feel how it's not our fault that the turning away happens. The turning away happens. How could it be our fault? It happens when we don't even realize. It happens in ways that it will take 20 years of refinement to start to be in touch with. How could we think of it as our fault? I mean, we do, but let's be more honest. It can't be our fault. It happens way beyond our control. And still can be addressed. And the first step to addressing it is that not our fault part. What I find is that the third and fourth of these difficult mind states, the wobbles that will come, the spacing out and the restlessness and remorse is the usual wording. I find that they go very much together, just as the first two go together. Lack and defensiveness. Turning away, spacing out, being immobilized, paralyzed, and not being able to stop the movement. So we can say spacing out and paralysis is the number three wobble, and the number four wobble is restlessness and remorse. Remorse, I tend to think of as a very good thing, and so I think what they mean is guilt. To me, remorse is when I can really feel the pain of what has happened, partly through my doing, and that pain allows me to learn, to stay open and to learn and find another way, and to redress in whatever way I can, which is not a problem and it's not a stuck mess. Whereas guilt is kind of the stuckness. So let's take it in reverse through the restlessness, which has become a culture now. We have a culture of restlessness and remorse. Restlessness and guilt. And isn't it curious that the Buddha put those two together as one thing a couple thousand years ago? And isn't it curious how much they go together in our culture? It's like we've become the poster children of restlessness and guilt. Please help us. It's very hard for us to stop when we know we need to stop. And one reason that it's really hard for us to stop, I think the main reason it's hard for us to stop, is that we feel guilty. We feel especially guilty for stopping. And part of this is in a really basic way we can talk about on a deep rest retreat. Several of you, at least in the room, would have had memories of being a child or an adult and someone criticizing you, punishing you, or making fun of you for stopping. Why are you wasting your time? Why don't you do something useful? The idea of the devil liking idle hands, idleness. And it seems to me that the more busy and then disconnected, the more out of our rhythm, the more busy, the more disconnected, the more guilty. It starts to seem to us that everyone is busy. I should be able to be busy and be myself. I should be able to have my rhythm and their rhythm. And we cannot. It is not true. We also notice that when we are in rhythm, we're more efficient. And so the whole dream of being busy and getting everything done can be seen for what it is. When we are restful, when our action is restful, our rest is creative, and our action is efficient. In fact, our rest is also very efficient. The first way it's efficient is that when we actually start to rest and we get a little bit into resting, the long list we had starts to check things off of itself that we suddenly realize are completely unnecessary and possibly harmful. As those start to check themselves off, there's a few things left to do. And if we keep resting more, those things can start to happen without even being a thing. They just happen. And then comes to mind the really important things to be done that we have been avoiding for 20 or 30 years. And this is where we come to the third difficulty, where we're paralyzed from doing what needs to be done. When we live restlessness and guilt, of course we don't have energy for what really needs to be done. And then of course we feel guilty. We're doing so much, there's not time to do what's important. But we know that that is important. And we know we've missed the time to do it also. The time to do that now is done. There are still other important things to do. But we missed those. They're over. If the guilt could turn to remorse, so that we start to massage out the paralysis, the being stuck, stuckness, the being stuck in turning away, turning away, turning away. Turning away from our vastness, and turning away from the tree full of fruit, and turning away from those one, two, or three things that we really need to get done today. Usually what needs to get done today is go and sit by the river for 5 minutes in the evening. It won't do to go at another time for longer the next day. It's this evening for 5 minutes. When we live this combination of paralysis, do you know what that word means? Being paralyzed. I'm unable to move. And restlessness, where I'm unable to stop. Honestly, finding a way to know how they go together . One is like where our wings are stuck closed, and one is like where our wings are stuck open. The way the Buddha talks about it is as being in prison for being paralyzed. We're not allowed to go out. Or being a slave. We're only allowed to do what someone else tells us to do. we're not independent. Or I think the way he puts it is we're not self-dependent, which is nice. It's different from independent. Later on, we would be released from slavery, self-dependent, independent of others, a freed person able to go where we want. A freed person able to walk through the tiny little wall or membrane of resistance to getting on with what's important, to leaving behind the perfectionism and guilt that stop us all day from being simple, from doing the simple things that must be done. It's hard to feel the difference at first between lying still on a deep rest retreat or sitting still if you prefer to sit and not doing, almost not doing anything. And where sometimes there's a heaviness and sometimes there's a lightness. It's hard to tell the difference between slowing down from restlessness and freeing our movement from the being paralyzed. It's hard to tell the difference between being paralyzed, being a prisoner, trying to be free. Am I just being restless? It's hard when we think about it. It's pretty easy when we stay with our feeling. What the Buddha mentions, he just, in the way the teachings have passed down, there are just these little clues. There's all these repeated phrases and then a slight difference. And the slight difference when he talks about being freed from being stuck, from being in prison, is that we are percipient of light. That means that we perceive light. There is brightness. So we could start to feel with different eyes for a kind of brightness in the just being still in a simple way, not in a being in prison kind of way. Sometimes we have to really encourage ourselves to stay still, and it's really worthwhile not to let the slave owner come and tell us what to do. I was going to say not to let the slave owner come and tell us what to do too soon, but what about not at all? Those other voices that are so right, so sure of what you should do. But feeling for a kind of brightness, it might just be a sort of brightness somewhere in the body where you receive your intuition. It's not necessarily when we hear the Buddha talking about percipient of light, I imagine like being kind of without a body and it's just brightness. Which sometimes it may be, don't be alarmed. But sometimes it might be more simple. Sometimes we can just, if we're not sure and it's not coming naturally, we're still practicing. We're not perfect. And we start to be less interested in being perfect. We could just, and we're just, it's a decision, this or that. It's not a free flow. We're pausing and deciding. Meditation hall river, meditation hall river. Just playing with what has brightness and following along. When we come out of the prison, the Buddha mentions that we are safe and secure with no damage to our property. Isn't that sweet? Mm-hmm. It feels to me like then, okay, past is past, and we made mistakes. But there's not maybe some real damage to what's important. What's important is safe. And we have a different kind of security that's not just about trying to stay still and not be noticed or trying to avoid noticing vastness or that one thing we need to do that scares us. That we feel, to be honest, we would usually feel we would rather die than do that thing, even if it's a simple thing like make a phone call or lie down. But one really simple, practical way that playing with the possibility of coming out of slavery and prison, being free to move about and being free to stay still, inwardly peaceful, the Buddha says, when we're free from the restlessness and remorse, when we're freed from slavery, freed from being told what to do all the time, inwardly peaceful. There can just be an ease of stillness when there is a magic moment, which sometimes there is in life, even if there's something uncomfortable. Sometimes there's a magic moment, and we can be available. We can be with that. Even if our back hurts a little bit or even a lot. And even if it's a more inner discomfort, like terror or panic in the face of vastness. With practice, there starts to be a freedom of movement and a freedom of stillness, where there's brightness with the stillness and inwardly peaceful with the movement. And we would be glad and full of joy. If we change it to what's more like our experience, we are glad and full of joy. It is a relief when we turn around with the help of the duck. When we just stay a little bit longer, maybe after the singing, enjoying that stillness, even if I'm not in my most comfortable position or whatever. Even if the thoughts are kind of coming in, so what? So we'll save the last difficult mind state for tomorrow. But I will mention the name of it, which is doubt. So you have a chance to say hello when doubt comes for a visit. Are there any questions or comments so far? She says a question about the duck moment. It happens in all our lives.
So sometimes I come across a duck, you know, or a thing that tells me maybe go back now or maybe do differently. And there's two ways in which I can feel tricked into not going back, maybe. One is feeling like the duck is a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, the duck is there to challenge me to make sure I really go to the goal.
Yeah.
And the other one is a feeling of responsibility, like if it involves somebody else or if it involves something I feel I've dedicated myself to.
Yeah.
I feel I need to go past it.
Yeah. Could you hear?
No.
She finds two excuses that keep her from turning around when it's time to turn around, to put it in summary. Is that okay like that? And one is taking the duck rather than as a kind of gentle confirmation of our intuition, rather as a challenge that's saying, go on, go to the end, which I'm not sure if there is an end in this case, but but where we come into our, in a way, it's a form of ill will, the will that wants to be on top, kind of. I want to take things as a fight. And so noticing where you are in your body when you think it might be a challenge to you to go on rather than an encouragement to listen. Noticing where you are in your body and with practice knowing when I'm where in my body, is it more trustworthy? So further down probably. And the second thing that helps her not listen to herself is the idea of responsibility and agreement with others, and a kind of way that I've dedicated myself to, committed myself to someone. And I think this takes experience, which you have, so it takes our experience into account. And again, really coming to the non-hypocrisy, where my responsibility with that person is what it really is love and wish for the best for that person. And my best knowing says turn around. And when it's more of the remorse, guilt, and what will they think of me, what will I think of me, more brittleness, then it's hard to have the courage. Then it takes courage instead of just simply, oh, let's turn around. But we have experience where the time that we turned around, there was something was more helpful. Or the other person couldn't make it anyway, or it was okay. Good, thank you. So I have the feeling just briefly to tell you the Buddha's metaphor for doubt, in case it's helpful or in case we don't actually end up, if I don't feel like speaking about it tomorrow, basically. He talks about it as, suppose a person with wealth and property were to enter a road across a desert. But later on, we would cross over the desert, safe and secure, with no loss to our property. Then, on considering this, we would be glad and full of joy. We can, when doubt comes, see it as a road across a desert, the Buddha suggests. And that when we find our way through doubt, which he's describing as a journey that we have to make, we make steps, we have to cross it. It's, I find, a little bit different from the other four difficulties or signs of breakthrough, as you like. But when we cross the desert, when we've walked through our doubts, it's as if we've come across a desert and we're in one piece and we have our things even. We're in a land of safety. So, and I used to only think of the desert as scary because I imagined at that time in the desert, and also maybe still today, it must be kind of full of robbers. And so it would be dangerous to be a person of wealth and property crossing the desert on foot, on a horse, on a camel, not in like a jeep or whatever. But I also think of the desert of doubt. There's not any water. And you do need to get all the way across it before you need anything. Before you need petrol, before you need water, before you need food, before you need shade, before you need a map. You need to get all the way across. You need to have what you need with you to get across. So just to leave that, what I find interesting metaphor for doubt. and opening the possibility that it's a different kind of journey through doubt than it is when we're in a soup of anger or in a soup of wanting what you have or in a soup of restlessness or a soup of being paralyzed. When doubt comes, it, I think, feels quite different and the journey is different. Or it is a journey. May our minds be flexible, steady, and bright. Free from the illusion of lack. Free from the habit of confirming that we are or are not. Free from turning away from what is. Free to turn with what is. May our gathering and our willingness to go into the depth of what is participate in a momentum towards liberation for all, everywhere.